The Torah states in a number of places, Lo sevashel gedi b'chalev imo, which means you are not allowed to cook meat and milk together. And the Gemara learns from the fact that this is reiterated three different times throughout Chumash, that there are three different components to this violation. Number one, one is not allowed to cook basar b'chalev together. Number two, one is not allowed to eat basar b'chalev that was cooked together. And number three, we assume one is not allowed to get any benefit from milk and meat that were cooked together. So those are the three prohibitions that are on a biblical level when it comes to milk and meat. It's important to know what's the Araisa and what is the Rabbanan, what is biblical and what is only rabbinic. So now we're just beginning with the biblical violation, with the biblical prohibition, which is you're not allowed to cook meat and milk together, you are not allowed to eat meat and milk that was cooked together, and you are not allowed to have benefit from meat and milk that were cooked together. So say, for example, a very prevalent example. So we have, you know, the most simple case that you can give is McDonald's has a lot of basar b'chalev in it. Now again, for non-Jews, there's nothing wrong with them eating basar b'chalev at all, but what about if I own the McDonald's? Or generally, that's not the case. How often am I going to own the McDonald's? But I want to buy shares in a McDonald's. Am I allowed to do so? Or do we consider that to be this third prohibition of deriving benefit and pleasure from basar b'chalev? And that's a major question in general. What do we do with stocks that we buy? Should we assume that once we buy a stock, we're considered to be really a partial owner? So let's say I own stocks in General Mills. Does it mean I have to sell all my stocks before Pesach because I am a partial owner in the company that's selling cereal that on Pesach I'm not allowed to have in my possession? These are all very important questions, but when it comes to basar b'chalev, that is a part of the question as well. If a person is not allowed to derive benefit from basar b'chalev, then that should be thought about in the various businesses that we might own. We're not allowed to own a non-kosher restaurant if they're selling basar b'chalev because we are going to be having benefit from that. Or say, for example, if I am a waiter or a waitress at one of these restaurants and I am the one who is now making money off the fact that I am, or the example they give is I'm a truck driver for McDonald's and now I'm going around delivering the various orders that people have placed, should I be in violation of a person who gets benefit, who derives pleasure from basar b'chalev or not? So this is all a very important issue. What we're going to talk about today is not so much the violation on a biblical level, but rather the extensions, the very far extensions that were made from that biblical violation. And that, as we know, is not only do we assume that you're not allowed to eat basar b'chalev, milk and meat that was cooked together, but we generally assume you're not even allowed to eat milk and meat that was not cooked together. That's generally what we do. We don't eat them in the same meal, even if they're on two different plates, even if they are not cooked together at all. And we also abstain from eating milk and meat one after the other. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Why did I choose to talk about this today? Because in this week's parsha, we have the famous story of Avraham Avinu meeting the three malachim, the three angels. And when they come to him, he has no idea that they're angels. He thought they were Arabs. He just sees three wandering strangers in the desert. He decides to welcome them in. And Avraham Avinu, as a very gracious host, decides to cook up a very delicious meal for them. So the pasuk says as follows, Vayikach chema v'chalav, this is number aleph, Avraham Avinu takes butter and milk, uven habakar asher asa, and he takes the steak, he takes the meat that he made for them, vayitein lifnehem, and he puts it before them, he serves it to them, v'hu amed alehem tachas ha'etz v'yochelo, and there Avraham Avinu is waiting in order that he should be able to serve them, to give them anything they need, as he is providing them with this delicious meal of chalav, which means butter and milk, as well as the meat that he prepared for them as well. Now, there's nothing wrong with Avraham Avinu serving this because he thinks that they are non-Jews. However, the Medrash tells us something very, very interesting. Look at the Medrash in number Beis, where the Medrash says that centuries later, when the Torah was given to the Jewish people, there was a major disagreement that broke out in heaven. What was the disagreement? So the Medrash says as follows, Melamed, Shehechilam basar b'chalav. Avraham Avinu served the malachim basar b'chalav. He makes chema v'chalav, he makes milk together with butter, and he puts that out for the meal together with the steak that he prepared for them. He served them basar b'chalav. Ukisheratza HaKadosh Baruch Hu litin Torah liYisrael. Many centuries later, when God wanted to give the Torah to the Jewish people, Amru HaMalachim, there was a disagreement that breaks out. The angels in heaven say, Tein Horcha Al HaShamayim. Why are you giving this over to mortals? Why are you giving this over to human beings? They don't know how to really keep to the laws of the Torah. They're going to violate the Averas. They are not going to do exactly as you want them to. Why are you giving this to them? You are tainting the Torah. Why not keep it with us, we should be the ones to be involved in the Torah and not the human beings. And God says to them, really? You claim that you're such righteous and holy people. I remember there was a story where you did not act properly. And what was that story? Amar Lahem, God responds to them and he says, Kasuv Torah, excuse me, Malachim, don't you know that it says explicitly in the Torah, Lo Sevasho Gedi Bachalev Imo, that you are not allowed to cook milk and meat together. Ve'atem, and you, Kishayaradatem Lamata, when you went to visit the home of Avraham Avinu, Achaltem Basar B'chalav. You ate something that you weren't allowed to eat. So what do you mean? You're so much greater than the human beings, you also made the mistake. You also did not follow the laws of the Torah, and therefore your argument is not a fair one. And therefore God decides, Miyahudu LaKadosh Baruch Hu, they gave in, they admitted that yes, we made a mistake, we did the wrong thing. You know what? You can give the Torah to the Jewish people. Which is an amazing story in and of itself. What exactly does it mean that the Malachim are fighting with God and they seem to have lost? Did they not know what happened? Did they not remember? But there's a very fascinating question that is asked by, there's someone by the name of the Rebbe of Heschel. The Rebbe of Heschel was the Rebbe of the Shach. The Shach, just to give a little historical context, the Shach is probably the foremost commentator on Shulchan Aruch Yerodeya, one of the volumes of Shulchan Aruch. What's amazing about the Shach, I didn't look up recently, but I remember something of this nature, that the Shach passed away somewhere around the age of 40. So the amount that he accomplished in the 40 years that he was alive, either 39 or 40, something like that, the Shach passed away at a very young age, and yet he became the foremost commentator on all of Shulchan Aruch Yerodeya. So the Shach had a Rebbe by the name of the Rebbe of Heschel. And they took the insights of Rebbe Heschel on Chumash, and they put it out in a sefer called Chanukah Satorah. So here in our parsha, the Chanukah Satorah asks a very simple observation. He says, here we have the Medrash tells us that we have a disagreement between God and the Malachi Asharis. The Malachim say, give us the Torah because human beings won't be able to keep the Torah. We're much greater than they are. God responds to them and he says, I remember there was a time when you all made a mistake. And therefore, I'm going to give it to the human beings because you're no greater than they are. So the Rebbe Rebbe asks a very simple question. If you think about the biblical violation of Basar B'chalav, what is it? Number one, you're not allowed to cook Basar B'chalav. Number two, you're not allowed to eat Basar B'chalav that was cooked together. And number three, you're not allowed to derive benefit or pleasure from Basar B'chalav. So the Malachim come and they register a complaint against God. God says back to them, no, you did wrong. You ate Basar B'chalav. Well, let's step back a minute. How did we get that Basar B'chalav? Avraham Avinu is the one who cooked it for us. And if he's the one who cooked it for us, he was in violation of the Avera first. So how is this the argument? How could it be that the Malachim lose the argument because they ate the Basar B'chalav? Why didn't they think to say back to God, Avraham Avinu also violated the same Avera. He set us up for the disaster. He cooked it together. So you have to say that obviously Avraham Avinu did not cook it together. Well, if that's the case, that the Basar B'chalav was not cooked together, then they were not in violation of anything either on a biblical level by eating it. If Avraham Avinu just brought out two plates to the table and one had milk and cheese and one of them had the steak, there's nothing biblically wrong with that. So how do you understand this conversation that took place between Avraham Avinu, between God and the Malachi Asharis when they went to visit Avraham Avinu? It's a very fascinating insight. It's an interesting question. But be it as it may, we have this medrash that tells us that we were victorious and we were able to get the Torah simply because of the story that happened in this week's parsha. That is the basic halacha. When you look in Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch says clearly that on biblical level we assume the only time there's a prohibition is when you have derech bishul, when the basar and the chalav were cooked together and you cook them in a way that you now plan to eat it. So take, for example, an offshoot of that, Rav Soloveitchik discussed, what if you have a student who's learning chemistry, or I don't know exactly what it is, or you go to a certain culinary school and you have to mix all kinds of things. So I don't have any intent to eat that item, and nobody has any intent to eat it. I'm just learning how to mix various ingredients together. Or if I'm going to a certain science class and they're telling me to mix this with that to see what the reaction is going to be, again, it might be cooked up, but it's not exactly considered cooking with any intent of eating. So is that also considered a violation of cooking basar b'chalav? Or do you say no? The only time cooking basar b'chalav is an issue is when you cook it with the intent of actually eating it. So that's a very important question that nowadays is much more relevant than it ever was. Where does this whole idea come from, that we have the right to extend the halacha further the way we know it? So for example, nowadays we wait between eating meat and milk. And we don't just wait a few seconds, a few minutes, we wait a long time. Where does that come from? That doesn't sound similar at all to what the Torah prohibited with the violation of Bisur B'Chalav. So where does this come from? So we look at number Gimel, where the Gemara tells us the source of where they came up with this idea. Ba'i minei Rav Asi me Rav Yochanan. Rav Asi asks Rav Yochanan the following question. Kama yisha bein basar legvina. How much should a person wait from the time that they eat meat until they are allowed to go ahead and eat cheeses or milk? Very fairly simple question that all of us know how to answer, but the Gemara was trying to figure out what the... So the Gemara answers very simply, Amar lei velo klum. You don't wait anything. Why would you wait? Why would you wait? The Torah doesn't prohibit you to eat meat and milk that was not cooked together. So you can have the steak at the table, and then you can bring out the next course, which is the milchig ice cream, and you can have all the different spreads that are all milchigs. No problem at all. Ask the Gemara Eini. That's not really true. V'ha amar Rav Chisda. Didn't Rav Chisda say that achal basar, if a person eats meat, asur le'achal gvina? You are not allowed to subsequently go ahead and eat cheese or milk. However, if you do it the opposite way, gvina, if you eat milk, mutter le'achal basar, you're allowed to go ahead later and eat meat. So how do you reconcile? So the Gemara says, now we have to change the question. Rather, the Gemara wants to know, how much does a person have to wait between eating milk and eating meat, which is not going to be our discussion for today. We have too much to talk about. We're not going to get there. And the Gemara is basically toying with this concept. We're trying to figure out, how do we know that a person is supposed to wait between eating meat and milk? That is not clear. If you look in the Pesuk Chumash, we don't have any indication of that. So you look a little further in the Gemara, skip down to the second to last line where we have a period. Amar Mar Ukva. Again, we're a number Gimel on the source sheet, second to last line by the period. Amar Mar Ukva. Anna laha milsa, with regard to this idea that one is not supposed to eat milk after they went ahead and had a meat meal, with regard to this practice, chala bar chamra lagabi abba. I am like vinegar in comparison to wine when you compare myself and my father. Now this is something that is a common refrain in my life. So when you think about how one compares to their father, so most of us try to follow in the footsteps of our parents, and we try to be similar to them in the positive aspects of what they do. In the negatives, we can leave behind. But in the positive aspects, we try to be like our parents. So here, the Gemara says, you know, whenever you have a great person, the children always have to figure out, how can they be like their parents, and how much do you assume that their parents are just living in a different stratosphere, and it's not exactly going to be implemented in their lives. They're not exactly the same. So the Gemara here has the very similar conversation. Mar Ukva says, I had a very great father. My father was like the very expensive fine wines, and I was like the vinegar. That's what he says. How does he highlight that point? How does he show that he's like vinegar in comparison to his father? What did his father do that made his father so special? And what did he do that made him so subpar? So the Gemara writes as follows. De'ilu abba, because my father, ki havi achil bisra ha'idna. Now, thank God we don't paskin like this, but when his father used to have meat during a meal at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, lo havi achil gevina ad-machar ad-hashta. He wouldn't have milk until 2 o'clock the next afternoon. He would wait 24 hours until he ate milk. Now, this is not the way we paskin, but he's saying, that's how great my father was. My father took upon himself that he was going to wait 24 hours in between the eating of meat and the subsequent eating of milk. V'ilu ana and nebuch poor me, mar ukva, I'm not as great as my father. And he says, b'ha su'udasa hudilo achilna, in the same meal I would never eat milk and meat together. However, l'su'udasa achrina achilna. I didn't exaggerate, I didn't go as far as my father did. So I didn't wait 24 hours between eating meat and eating milk. However, I waited from one meal to another, which is a very subjective term that we'll get to in a few minutes. What does it mean from one meal to another? There are some people, like myself, every time I pass by the kitchen, I take something to eat. That's just the way I am. Some people are not that way. Some people are very regimented. Some people are very careful with the way they eat and the way they nibble and the way they nosh, and they only have three meals a day or two meals a day. They cut out meals. So exactly does the Gemara mean that he was careful not to have milk until the next meal? What does the next meal mean? It depends who you ask. So we'll see in a few minutes, that's where the discrepancy comes about as to how much time a person should wait. But basically, the Gemara says here that Mar Ukva said about himself that his father was a great person because his father waited 24 hours, and he only waited from one meal to the next. Now, there's a very obvious observation that one can make when reading this Gemara. You take, for example, you have a child of a great person. So let's say somebody, I don't know what's a great character trait of a person, but let's say you have, you know, my father's incredibly humble. So I'm not. I don't have the same midos as him. And I think that his humility is something that goes beyond my ability. It's something that goes beyond my ability of a way that I can act. Right now, it's not the way I am. Maybe I'll grow at some point, but right now, I don't feel it's the way I am. I can say about my father's such a great man that he's such a humble person, I don't even touch any of that piece of humility that he exemplifies, that he represents. But if I said about my father's a great man, you know why? Because he comes to shul on time every day. And I'm like the spoiled milk, you know, I'm nothing like him. So if I see such a virtue in my father, it's not so difficult to follow in that footstep. It's not so difficult for me to come to shul on time as well. That's something that is humanly possible. It's something that I can attain on my own. So I wouldn't say such a thing. My father's so great because he comes to shul on time, so work on yourself and get to shul on time. It's not so hard. So over here, you can observe in the Gemara says, my father was so great, he's bemoaning the fact that his father was such a great person that his father waited 24 hours between eating milk and eating meat. Sorry, the other way around. So why don't you just do it? If you're feeling so self-conscious about it, so that's something you can attain, that's something you can do. It might be a little difficult, but it's not something that's so bashamayim, it's not so out of your reach. So why doesn't he go ahead and follow in the footsteps of his father and do the same thing? And here, I believe, is a very important concept that is brought out from the Gemara. There are a number of mefarshim who say it, but one of the beautiful sources that I saw is in the number Dalad, the Arvei Nachal. He writes as follows, V'kasha. Bishlema adam acher she'eno noig behanhagazu. If you have a different person outside of the family of Marukva who never experienced a father that acts in such a way, yesh lomar she'eni yodezos. You understand why they don't follow such a practice, because they don't even know about it. They're not accustomed to such practices. They don't know that there is such an idea that you can act in such a way. Ki lo shama adayin sheroi linhokach. They've never heard of such a thing. Masha enkein hu, but Mar Ukva himself, shekvar ra o shama me'aviv shenoha kach. If he sees that this is the way his father acts, and he wants to emulate it, and he says, my father is such a great man, well, if you want to be great, why don't you just do the same thing? V'hayu lo gaguim, and he's feeling guilty about the fact, al osan hagat shekar la'atzma chale, he calls himself spoiled milk, he calls himself vinegar. If you want to elevate yourself, act like your father, what's the big deal? And he answers in Cain, Madua lo nahakach, why doesn't he follow in the footsteps of his father? Why doesn't he do the same thing? Acha inyan, he writes as follows, Avodas Hashem tzarech lios behadraga. Person always has to keep in mind, and this is a very, very important and fundamental principle that he tells us, that whenever a person feels that they want to come close to the Ribono Shel Olam, that they want to have a relationship, it needs to be a gradual process. You don't skip stages. It's the same way if you have a couple that's dating, they don't skip stages. Everything goes gradually. They have to first get to know each other. They have to get to know each other a little more profoundly, a little more deeply. And then, once they know each other well enough, they're ready to get married. But to get married on a first date would be highly inappropriate. It wouldn't make sense. They wouldn't be able to handle that kind of relationship. It's not really what we would expect. And that's the same thing here. Avodas Hashem, our relationship that we create, that we have, with the Ribono Shel Olam, has to be done behadraga. It has to be done gradually, and it has to go through a process, which is why psychologically they say it's very dangerous as well. Sometimes kids go to Israel and all of a sudden they snap from one day to the next and they want to change everything about their lives and throw out everything that they did before. Now again, they might want to change the way that they're leading their lives. That's a wonderful thing, but it all has to be done gradually. Otherwise, it's a very dangerous thing to do. And it's something that normally will not last. If somebody is going to make a change too drastically, it's not going to last. And that's what he writes here as well. Yesh midas chasidus de aser lehisnaig bahem, rak mi shemuchza kvar bechasidus. Mar Ukva says about his father, my father took upon himself to act in a very pious manner. I'm not up to there. Maybe one day I'll get there. But right now, in the way I am, it's just not who I am. I don't have such a relationship with God. My father always says, how the Mishnah Berurah writes very often, bal nefesh yachmir. When you have somebody who's a very pious person, you should be machmir in such an area. Let's say, you know, the Mishnah Berurah writes that about carrying the Erev. Somebody who's a real big tzaddik, tzedkanius, whatever. So don't carry an Erev, even if the Erev is kosher, because you're relying on all kinds of things. You may as well not carry the Erev. So, for all of us who are not such big tzaddikim, we all carry the Erev. But for somebody who's really a tremendous Baal Nefesh, somebody who's a really serious Machmir, and somebody who has a very pious lifestyle in other areas of life, so they have the right, the Mishnah Berurah says, it would make sense for them also not to carry the Eruv. So we have aspects of that in Halacha all over the place. But it's important to keep in mind, my father always says, when he was growing up, when you read that line in the Mishnah Berurah, Baal Nefesh Machmir, you said, yeah, that's the big tzaddik over there, that's me. Nowadays, he says, every guy in yeshiva opens it up. He says, oh, Baal Nefesh Yachmer is me. So, it's just not appropriate. It's not an appropriate way to take chumras upon ourselves when there's so much at the baseline level of halacha that we're not careful about yet. So it just looks funny. He brings an example here in the next paragraph. We won't read it, but he says, the Gemara writes in Maseches Sota. It's a very interesting application. He says, the Gemara says in Maseches Sota, the unfortunate story of when you have a woman whose husband is accusing her, and they have substantial evidence to assume that something went wrong. So you bring her to the Beis HaMikdash, and you go through the whole process. It's a very humiliating process, and that's what the Gemara describes. So the Gemara says that there's a certain process that the woman has to go through in the Beis HaMikdash. They change her clothing, they make her wear black clothing that makes her look unattractive, and whatever it is, the Gemara goes through it. So then the Gemara has the question, should we also make the woman remove her jewelry? Because that will humiliate her even more. If you tell her she has to remove her jewelry, now she's going to feel very down about herself. Now she's going to feel, I'm not even wearing my jewelry. They made me take off all my regular clothing. And now she's going to be even more humiliated. Maybe we should make her take it off. And the Gemara has a statement. No. Keep the jewelry on. Why? Because gavra artilai v'sayim misani. Imagine you have somebody who runs out naked into the street and they're just wearing the fancy gold belt. You laugh at the person. You don't say, oh, look at that beautiful piece of jewelry. You say, you look like a fool. You don't even realize what you're doing. So it doesn't look better for a person to wear jewelry when they're not wearing any clothing on. And that, says the Gemara, is exactly what we try to do by the Sota as well. She looks humiliated by the clothing that she's wearing. We keep her jewelry on. It makes her look even more foolish. That's what the Gemara assumes. And that's what he writes over here as well. Sometimes you have a person who is religiously gavra artilai, who is religiously a naked person running around the streets, not even realizing how silly they look. V'sayim asani, they're wearing a beautiful earrings. What does it help not to carry the Erev if you're not keeping to the rest of Hilchos Shabbos? That's not the first step to go. And that's what he writes over here. Person has to be very careful about how and when they take upon themselves various midas chasidas and various chumras. It's not made for everyone. It's not made for every stage. Avodas Hashem, our relationship with God, has to be something that is a gradual process. And it has to be done in a healthy way. If a person is not ready for that, you have to do everything at a time when you're ready. Again, we should strive to want to do everything in the most pristine way possible. But that's not always something that everybody's ready to do. He then goes on in the final paragraph on this side of the page. He quotes an Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, which is a not a literal interpretation of a pasuk, but one of the Aseres HaDibros that we know is Lo Sisa Shem Hashem Elokecha Lashav. Person is not allowed to carry, is not allowed to throw around the name of Hashem in vain. Which means you have to have certain respect for the Shem Hashem, and you can't just throw around God's name for no good reason. So the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh on Chumash has an insight that perhaps it means something on a deeper level as well. Perhaps it means not only are you not allowed to throw on the name of Hashem in vain, but it means Lo Sisa Shem Hashem Elokecha Lashav. Means, don't hold up the banner of God's name when it's false. Which means, sometimes you have people parading around the street saying, we're the big tzaddikim, we're the big this, we're all the machmir. Meanwhile, in their own personal life, they're not upholding that standard. They're not upholding the level. That, says the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, is a biblical violation of Lo Sisa Shem Hashem Elokecha Lashav. You are not allowed to carry the banner of God and say, I am the one who's the faithful, the loyal servant. I'm the one who does everything God wants, and that's the way you portray yourself publicly, when meanwhile inside in your own personal and private life, it's not at all what you're really thinking or what you're feeling or how you act. And that, says the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, is something to be careful about. And that's exactly what our Gemara writes here, that not every chumrah is made for everybody. You can be as great as Marukva, but if he's not ready for that stage, he doesn't take upon himself the chumrah of his father. I know in our house, my father is a tremendous machmir about everything, but when we were growing up, he never told us anything. Never said anything about the way he acts and the way he does things, because he felt that that's his personal anhaga. The things that he does in his personal life are for him. It's not for his children. His children are young. His children are not ready for that. And it's not something that he has to push on us. If he decides to take it upon himself, good. If we decide later on in life that it's appropriate for us, it's a different thing. But it's something he always was careful never to share with us, because he felt that it was an inappropriate time for his children to be acting like him, when in fact we were not and still are not on the level that he is. So that's something that comes forth from this Gemara, which I think is a very beautiful point to be aware of. We're going to skip the next source on the second side of the page, but you can read it on your own. That's from one of the Svarim of Rav Amar, where he highlights the very same point, that a person always has to be careful to have a balance between the way they act in private and the way they act in public. And the way that they act in public has to reflect the private thoughts and the private ways that they act as well when nobody else is watching and nobody else is paying attention to that which they might be doing. Rav Amar makes another point, which I think is worth mentioning. It's a little bit connected to this, and he makes the point that a person also has to be careful. Sometimes we say, well, what can you lose by taking upon yourself the chumrah? It's a little bit annoying, it's a little bit difficult, it's a little bit this, but okay, I'm willing to annoy myself a little bit for God, right? That's what you say sometimes. So why not take upon yourself the chumrah? So he writes that every chumrah comes along with a kula on the other side. You know, sometimes you have children who go to Israel, they decide, I want to be machmir on this and this hashgacha, I want to be machmir on that. Then they come home, and it's a kula for their kibud av aim. So again, if it's appropriate, it's appropriate, but if it's inappropriate, and if it's going to be cutting corners in other areas of halacha, you have to know enough to really know where is it appropriate and where is it not. So this is something to be careful about as well. Rama writes the story that there was there's a famous opinion that the Gemara talks about, that the Achronim have, that a behema shahara ba chacham, you don't eat at all. What does that mean? It means if there was ever a shaila with this chicken, if there was ever a shaila with this pot of soup, if there was something wrong that they had to ask a shaila from a chacham to know what to do. So we know that there are halachas of bitul b'shishim. We know that if some drop of milk spills into the pot, so there's ways of calculating whether the pot can still be consumed or not. But there are those who are careful that behema shahara ba chacham, if somebody had to take this pot of soup or this chicken or this whatever to go and ask a rabbi a shaila, I stay away from it. I don't ever eat anything that has shailas asked. I don't want to get involved in questions. There are those who do that. We generally don't do that, but there are those who are very careful. So Rav Amar writes that there was a young boy who went to yeshiva. He heard about this halacha, behema shahara ba chacham. When somebody asked the Talmud Chacham a question, you shouldn't get involved in the issue. You shouldn't consume that food. You shouldn't be involved in the question at all, and stay far away from it. So this young boy was very inspired by that, and he said, you know, I'm going to do that as well. So that year, Sukkot came around. He went home for Sukkot, and he was sitting there, and there was a whole shiloh with the sukkah. What about this, and what about that? And they called the rabbi over of the community, and the rabbi came, and he said, everything's fine. So the boy said, nope, behema shahara ba chacham. If you have something that you have to ask a shiloh about, you don't eat there. So the boy decided to eat the whole sukkah inside the house. So again, Rav Amar points out that you don't even understand what the baseline halacha is, so how do you have the right to go and take upon a chumrah upon yourself? You're not ready for that. You don't even understand that the baseline halacha is that on sukkahs you have to eat in the sukkah. You want to go ahead and say that any sukkah that ever had a shaila asked on it, you don't want to sit in it. Okay, that's your chumrah. But if you're not even understanding what the baseline obligation is and what you're supposed to be doing, you're going to misrepresent what the halacha is. And that we have to be very careful about as well. Whenever we have this area of chumrah in our lives, not to cut corners in other areas in order to fulfill the chumrah in one area of life. So again, as we started, the biblical prohibition is that one is not allowed to eat meat and milk that were cooked together. You're not allowed to cook them together, and you're not allowed to have any benefit from them. We have a later rabbinic prohibition that you're not even allowed to eat them together if they haven't been cooked with one another. You're still not allowed to eat them together. Now again, let's make it clear that that's a rabbinic prohibition. This applies not only to meat, but it applies to chicken as well, which is surprising, because the whole biblical prohibition in the first place never applied to chicken. The whole biblical prohibition is you're not allowed to cook meat and milk together. The chicken part was never said. So that's another extension. The reason why I'm highlighting the fact that all of this is such extensions of extensions of extensions is because since this is so far removed from the original halacha that the Torah stated, that's why we have a lot of room to be makel when it comes to young children, when it comes to people who might not be feeling well, when it comes to various aspects of life, we have a lot of room to be makel with regard to the waiting. What is the reason why the Gemara says you should wait between eating meat and eating milk? Where does that come from? So again, we saw the source, but why did they come up with this idea? That's a disagreement between Rashi and the Rambam. Rashi says the reason why is very simple. You eat a juicy steak, the taste is going to linger in your mouth. You eat a heavy meat meal, the taste is going to be there for a while. Your digestive system takes a little while for that to get out. Sometimes the taste is very heavy, very strong, it's going to be lingering in your mouth. And therefore, you should not go ahead and eat milk afterward for a certain amount of time. Now, how long is that time? We'll see soon. That's the opinion of Rashi. The Rambam is of the opinion that no, the reason why you're not allowed to do this is because basar ben hashinayim. Because you eat a thick, juicy steak, it's going to get stuck in your teeth. They didn't have a fork and knife back then. So you bit into the steak, it gets stuck in your teeth, and then when you go ahead and you eat something afterward, you didn't have floss, you didn't have a toothpick, you didn't have whatever it was, it's going to get stuck in your teeth. And therefore, says the Rambam, that's why we say you have to wait a certain amount of time, and we assume after that time, everything that's in your mouth probably dissolved, is probably not edible anymore, and you're no longer going to have to worry about whatever it is that you ate earlier on in the day. What is the difference between these two opinions of Rashi and the Rambam? So let's say one example, which is not so common nowadays, but this is an example that the Acharonim discuss. I guess back in the days when they didn't have a fork and knife and you want to give your child some meat, so how are you going to give the child some meat? So the parent, you take a bite out of the piece and then put it on the high chair. I guess if they didn't have a fork and knife, they didn't have a high chair either. But they would put the piece of meat that they bit in front of the child, and then the child would be able to eat it. So I had no intention of eating the steak, and I didn't really consume it. All I did was I took a bite out of it to give it to my child, to make it edible for them. So this would be dependent on the disagreement between Rashi and the Rambam. If Rashi is right, that the whole issue here is that the taste is going to linger in your mouth, when I simply take a bite out of it, I don't have the taste in my mouth, it goes away right away. It only lingers a taste if I swallow it. However, according to the opinion of the Rambam, that we're concerned of it being stuck in between your teeth, there would be no issue at all here, because we assume you're just taking a little bite and then you're going to give it to your child. It's not going to get stuck at all. Rav Moshe Feinstein has another interesting case, which I'm not sure exactly what the... I don't know exactly what he's describing, but apparently there was such a thing, maybe there still is, about a fleishig of vitamin. Is there such a thing as a pill that's fleishig, that has meat products in it? I don't know exactly what it is. You ever heard of it? What? Thyroid supplements? Uh-huh. Right, so the gelatin is a separate story, but let's say you have a kosher pill, whatever it is, but it has meat ingredients in it. I don't know exactly what it is, but let's say. So Rav Moshe says, if you take such a pill, you don't have to wait between taking the pill and going ahead and eating milk. Why? Because he says both reasons here don't apply. It doesn't taste like meat, you don't have any taste lingering in your mouth, and you're not chewing it either. And even if you do chew it, that's not called derech achila. You're not chewing it because this is what you want to consume, you're chewing it because that's what your health tells you need to do. So that's why Rav Moshe says, there's no reason to be careful after you take a pill that might have meat ingredients in it. You don't have to wait after that. Our Gemara says a very subjective concept here. The Gemara says you have to wait misu'uda l'su'uda. You have to wait the time between one meal and another. What exactly does that mean? As we mentioned, every time I walk by the kitchen, I take something to eat. So does that mean I'm allowed to eat milk 5 minutes after I ate meat? And for somebody else who only eats breakfast and dinner every day and they skip lunch, they have to wait a whole day? Is that really... reasonable? Is that really what we assume? So this is a major, major discussion in the Rishonim. Many of the Rishonim say the Gemara is to be understood very literally. From one meal to the next means you can have the biggest Shabbos meal, the biggest Thanksgiving meal, whatever you're going to have. You're going to serve your turkey and your meat and your chickens and a very heavy meal. As long as you clear the table and you bench, now you start a new meal, you can have milchigs right away. That's what many of the Rishonim assume, because they take the Gemara literally. The Gemara says from one meal to the next, and that's good enough. Now, it's clear that they're obviously assuming, not like Rashi and not like the Rambam. Because as we mentioned, the two reasons, the two major reasons that we give for why one is not allowed to eat milk right away is because either it gets stuck in your teeth or because the taste lingers in your mouth. Both of those would not be applicable if you assume that as long as you bench and clear the table, that's good enough. That really should not be the case. So the understanding of these Rishonim is that no, the reason why you have to wait between milk and meat is because we assume that we want to make a hecker. We want to make sure that you don't confuse it and later cook the milk and meat together. So if you know that you're always going to have a very clear separation between the milk and the meat, that's good enough to make sure you never lead yourself to the real biblical prohibition. That's basically the understanding of these Rishonim. However, this is not generally the accepted opinion. And we generally say you have to wait longer than just benching after a meal. That's not going to be sufficient. So the Rama writes, very surprisingly, the Rama says that you have to wait 1 hour between eating milk, I'm sorry, between eating meat and eating milk afterward. 1 hour is good enough. The Chacham Tzvi, what? So this is really, surprisingly, the opinion of the Rama, which is surprising because we follow the Rama. Ashkenazim, Sephardim in the room are going to have different, but the Ashkenazim generally follow the Rama in every other area of Halacha. So over here, all of a sudden, the Rama says 1 hour. That's a very surprising statement to us, because I would imagine most people in the room don't just wait 1 hour. It would make life very easy, but most of us don't. So where does this 6 hours come from? Where does that stem from? So you look in the Rambam, number Vav. And the Rambam tells us as follows. Misha achal basar betchila. Somebody who eats meat. Bein basar behema, bein basar of. Whether you ate meat or poultry, whether you ate chicken or meat. Lo yochal achar av chalav. You should not have any milk products afterwards. Ad sheyisha beineihem kedei shiur seuda acheres. Until you wait the amount of time which is normal between your two meals. Vuhu, and how long is that, says the Rambam? Kimo sheish shos. So some people think that means into the sixth hour. That's not what the Rambam means here. Kimo sheish shos means the Rambam didn't have a watch. So there was no precision. So the Rambam means you wait around 6 hours when the sundial was here, and then the sundial is around 6 hours later, so then you can eat the meat. Where does the Rambam come up with this arbitrary number? I don't wait 6 hours between breakfast and lunch. I would not survive. Right? So why do we assume that 6 hours is the magic number? Where does it come from? So the answer is, the Mefarshim explained that the Rambam is based off the Gemara. The Gemara says they weren't as affluent as we are. They didn't used to have 3 meals a day. Nobody was able to afford that. But you had to eat. So what did you do to take care of yourself? So what you did is you woke up in the morning at the crack of dawn, but you didn't eat, because in the morning you can handle not having food. So then you would wait a little bit to eat, and you would basically push your meal off to like 11 o'clock. This way it's like a brunch, so to speak. And then you waited another 6 hours till the end of the day, and you had like an early dinner. So therefore the Rambam says, in the times of Chazal and the times of the Gemara, they only had 2 meals during the day. One of them was like halfway through the morning, the other one was halfway through the afternoon, and that's all they would eat during the day, and that's it. Therefore the Rambam says, if our Gemara says you have to wait the amount of time between one meal and another, that means 6 hours. And that's where the Rambam's opinion comes from. And this, the Ramah ends off, and he says, even though I really feel that 1 hour would have been good enough, and 1 hour is really, strictly speaking, all you need, the Ramah himself says, v'nachon, it's right, it's the proper thing to do, like the opinion of the Rambam, to wait 6 hours. Not only that, the Shach writes on the side of the page there, the Shach says, kol mi sheyesh bo reach Torah. Now, I don't know what that means exactly, but anyone who has the spirit of Torah will be careful to wait 6 hours. That's what the Shach comments in the name of the Marshal, which my father once told me, if I'm not mistaken, that anyone here from the German community? So I grew up in Washington Heights, so the German community waits 3 hours. So they wait 3 hours. I don't know if it's because in Germany they used to have smaller meals, you know, more frequently during the day, or I'm not sure exactly what the reason is, but 1 second. Basically, the German community all have the practice that they wait 3 hours. There's nothing wrong. So somebody went to Rav Schwab and he said, our family has the practice, our whole community has the practice to wait 3 hours, but Rav Schwab told him, even though it's our community's practice, the Shach says, nonetheless, kol mi sheyesh bo reach Torah, somebody who has the right sensitivity for Torah will wait 6 hours, even though our community and our practice personally is that we wait three. Rav Schwab himself, who was the rabbi of their community, said, if you're able to do it, you should really wait six. So again, not everybody has to be on that madrega. Not everybody has to do that. But if your community has the practice 6 hours, this is where it comes from. It comes from the fact that the Rambam says 6 hours, and it comes from the fact that we assume that in the times of Chazal, the space that they had in between meals was a 6 hour delay. That's generally the way it worked. My father once told me over that when he was in Rav Soloveitchik's shir and they saw this Rambam, when the Rambam says Kemo Shei Shos, somebody thought it meant like Mixas Hayom Kekula, the same way on the last day of Shiva, you just observe a little bit in the morning and that's good enough. So somebody thought that's what the Rambam means. You observe a little bit of the 6 hour and that's good enough. So Rav Soloveitchik was very opposed to that interpretation of the Rambam. It's not what the Rambam means. Rav Soloveitchik said the Rambam just means to say, we didn't have watches, so you don't have to make yourself crazy and wait 8 hours. You can wait sometime around 6 hours, and that would be good enough. Yeah?
So would that suggest that thinking that you had, that you said about Rav Schwab, would that also explain why the Rambam, who passed him for Eidot Mizrach and Kedilot Sepharad, held 3 hours? Did he hold 6 hours, but he passed him? Sephardim only hold 3 hours.
I don't know.
All
Sephardim only keep three?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Again, all of these practices are fine. All of them are fine. And again, as we mentioned, the Ramah says clearly that strictly speaking, you only have to wait 1 hour. And that's why the Chasam Sofer writes, let's say a person is not feeling well. Now, what exactly does not feeling well mean? Everybody has their own definition of not feeling well. But here the Chasam Sofer writes, because we're talking about an extension of an extension of an extension of an extension of an original din d'oraisa, that you're not allowed to eat milk and meat that were cooked together, because it's so far removed, therefore the Chasam Sofer writes, la halacha, and this is the way we generally assume, that if a person is not feeling well, and it doesn't mean you have to be sick with pneumonia and really not feeling well, it means what the Chasam Sofer would call a bari b'mechash ba'alma. It means you're generally healthy, but you have a little fever, you have a little something, you're just not feeling well. That's already good enough to say that after 1 hour you can go ahead and have the ice cream and have something else because you're not feeling well. There's no reason to be machmir if a person is not feeling well. Again, it doesn't mean you have to be really not feeling well. The Chasam Sofer writes, even a person who is a little bit not feeling well has the right to be mekel after 1 hour. That's based on the idea that the Rama writes here, that after 1 hour already we assume that would be sufficient. Generally in halacha, whenever we talk about a mitzvah that has to be done within a certain amount of hours, there's a major issue that you have to be aware of. Let's say, for example, Kriya Shema in the morning, we have something called the Sof Zman Kriya Shema, which means you only have a certain amount of time within which you can say the Kriya Shema. After that, it's too late. So say, for example, somebody in the morning is getting their kids out for school, and then they have the other kid has to go to the doctor, and by the time you come home, it's already 11 o'clock. Well, it's very nice that you want to sit down and daven, but it's too late. You missed the Zman Kriya Shema, or you missed the Zman Tefillah. There's only a certain amount of hours that you have in the day to daven and to say Kriya Shema. That's something everyone should be aware of. You gain nothing, and it's perhaps a bracha lebatala if you're going to daven after the Zman Tefillah is already complete. So that's something to be careful about. But over here, the question is, whenever the Torah says that you have a certain amount of hours, let's say 3 hours into the day, 4 hours into the day, or Erev Pesach, we say you have 6 hours into the day when you can eat chametz, and then after that you're not allowed to eat chametz anymore. So how do we calculate those hours? We have two ways of calculating hours. One is the way we generally calculate an hour, which is the day is split up into 24 hours. Every hour is the same amount of time. Every hour is 60 minutes. That's what we call sha'os shavos. Means they are equal hours no matter what time of year you're holding in, no matter what kind of country you live in, no matter how light or dark it is outside. Every hour is a shos shavos. Every hour is exactly 60 minutes, doesn't make a difference. Halachic hours are calculated by shos zmanios. That's what we call shos zmanios. Shin, ayin, vav, taf, shos. Zmanios means it depends on the time. So what does that mean? The hour depends on the time? How do I explain what that means? So the answer is, a halachic hour means, the assumption that Chazal worked with was, every day is 24 hours. 12 hours of that 24 are supposed to be given to the day, to the daylight hours, and 12 hours of that 24 are supposed to be allocated for the nighttime hours. Now, that's not always going to add up, because during the winter months, when the night is much longer, how do you give the same 12 hours that you gave during the summer? So the answer that the Chazal explain is that a halachic hour is not only 60 minutes. A halachic hour is, you take the daylight hours, you figure out how many minutes there are in the daytime, and then you split that up, divided by 12. So sometimes you can have a halachic hour that's going to be 35 minutes when you have shorter days, and sometimes you can have a halachic hour that's going to be 75 minutes. If you have longer nights and you have to split up many more minutes by 12 hours, you can have a halachic hour that's going to be 75 minutes. That's what we call sha'os zmanios. It depends at what time of year you're up to. That's going to depend how long the hour is going to be. Does that make sense? So over here, if I would ask you, when it comes to Zman Kriya Shema, and when it comes to Zman Tefillah, when it comes to all these different things, we assume you have to follow the halachic calculation of hours, which means you have to follow the 75-minute hour, or at this time of year, maybe it's a 35-minute hour, whatever it is, you have to know what that is. Nowadays, it's very easy for us online, they have everything. But back in the times of the Gemara, they had to figure this out. It wasn't so simple. So how would you understand when it comes to waiting 6 hours? Which kind of 6 hours are you supposed to wait? Do you wait 6 60-minute hours, or do you wait 6 halachic hours in order to be allowed to eat milk after you've consumed meat? What would you say? You would say 60-minute hours. Why? Because that's what we do. Okay, that's the easy answer. But think about it very simply. Think about it very logically. It's based on the reasons. If the reason is, it's very simply based on the logic that we discussed. If the reason for not having milk after meat is simply because we don't want you to have the taste lingering in your mouth, what does it matter if today a halachic hour happens to be 75 minutes or a halachic hour happens to be 35 minutes? The taste is going to linger for the same amount of time. So we generally assume that when you have to wait 6 hours or 3 hours or 1 hour, whatever you're doing based on your family practice, you have to wait a 60-minute hour. You don't wait a halachic hour. You wait a 60-minute hour because this is of physical nature. We're trying to figure out, is the person really still going to have the taste of meat in their mouth, or should we assume that it's been long enough that they're no longer going to have that? So that's something to be aware of as well, that when we talk about the amount of time that has to be waited here, this is in some an anomaly. It's unusual. Over here we say you wait a general hour that we are all familiar with, a 60-minute hour, whereas by most other areas of halacha you have to wait a halachic hour, for Zman Kriya Shema or for Zman Tefila. There is a discussion that people ask all the time, do I have to wait 6 hours from the time that I ate the meat or from the time that the meal was completed? Am I the only one that's had this question? So you have a Shabbos meal, and sometimes you have a guest who you really enjoy having over once in a while, and when you're talking to that person, you can serve the main course, and then the main course is already cleared, and now that's already done at 1 o'clock, but they can sit around in the house until 3 o'clock. So do I have to wait 6 hours from 1 o'clock or 6 hours from 3 o'clock, the time when we finish the meal and bench? That's a question that is discussed in all the Achronim. The Shach writes in the name of the Ran that you have to wait 6 hours mishas ha'achila. You have to wait 6 hours from the time that you ate, that you consumed the meat. And therefore the Badei HaShulchan is one of the very important poskim to know about nowadays. His name is Rav Feivel Kohn. He's a contemporary. So Rav Feivel Kohn, not a contemporary of mine, contemporary of my father. So he, Rav Feivel Kohn, writes in his very important sefer, Badei HaShulchan, that when it comes to waiting the 6 hours, a person can wait, let's say you're in the middle of the Shabbos meal, even though you're going to have the dessert, and the dessert is still on the table that we used all the fleishiks for, and I didn't bench yet. You just have to wait from the time that you finish eating the meat. And then he says in the opposite direction as well. Let's say 6 hours later, let's say 5 hours later, I want to serve another meal that's going to be milchigs based. It's going to be ziti and whatever it might be. But the first course of the meal is going to be salads or all kinds of things that are not milk, that are not dairy at all. Do I have to wait to begin that second meal until 6 hours have passed? Or can I serve the first course in the meal because that's not milchigs at all? Can I serve the first course within the 6 hours? And there says the Badei HaShulchan, you have a right to begin the meal even though you're within the 6 hours, because the first part of the meal is not going to be a milchig part of the meal at all. And the same way you have to only count from the time that you ate the meat, so too you only have to finish by the time you're about to eat the milk. Now again, you have to be careful about it because you don't want people to make the mistake, and if the meal goes quicker than you thought, you have to be careful about that, but it is something to be aware of. We do not need to wait until the benching. You have to just wait from the time that you ate the meat. One final question that we'll discuss, because we're running out of time, is something that I would imagine happens not only in our home, but happens in other places as well. Let's say you have somebody who eats a meat meal, and now, within the six hours, they see a very delicious-looking Reese's bar or whatever it is, some kind of Hershey's Kisses, and they make a bracha on it, and they want to eat it. And then they realize, they just make a bracha on fleishiks. Ever happened to anybody? So that's the question. So what do you do? So what is a person supposed to do if they make that mistake? They're within the 6 hours. They're supposed to be waiting another few hours in order to eat the milk, but they've just made a bracha. What? What do you mean? No, sometimes a person sees a snack on the counter and they make a bracha on it. Or they have to wait another hour, let's say. So now they've already made the bracha. They're holding the item in their hand. What are you supposed to do? So some mistakenly think that you should grab something else. So for example, I make a shahakol on my chocolate bar, and now I realize, so I take a cup of water. But you're not really allowed to do that. For example, we have in Hilchos Brachos the following case. Let's say somebody is holding an apple in their hand, and I make a Bori Pri Ha'etz. And now, before I have a chance to take a bite, it drops out of my hands, something happens, and it drops into the mud, and now I'm not going to eat it. So what do? I just made a Ha'etz, but I'm not going to eat the apple. So I see there's a banana on the banana's not a good example. I see there's a grape on the counter. I like grapes, but I wasn't planning on having grapes right now. So the Shulchan Aruch says you have to make a new bracha. Because when you made the bracha of Ha'etz, you had no intention of eating that grape. You only had intention to eat the apple. Now that it falls out of your hands and some unforeseen circumstance came up, too bad, what are you going to do? But your bracha cannot count for something that you had no intention of eating at all. And that's why over here, that would not be an answer to say, oh, I made the bracha on the chocolate bar, let me make sure that I go and get a cup of water now. That doesn't help because you had no intention of drinking the cup of water right now. Your bracha was for the chocolate bar, not for the cup of water. If you had a cup of water poured already and you were going to make the bracha on both of them, so then obviously if something goes wrong with one, you can take the other. And that would be the same for the grapes and the apples. If you had intention to have a whole bunch of items, obviously your bracha goes on everything. But if you did not have intention for that, and the only reason you're doing it is because some emergency came up, in a case like that, that would not be a way out. So what do you do in a case like this? Let's look at the following. Rav Avadya Yosef, whose yahrzeit was actually this past week, his neshama should have an aliyah, Rav Avadya Yosef writes the following. And here, I don't know if anyone's ever read the tshuvas of Rav Avadya Yosef, but in the tshuvas Yabia Omer, every tshuva is like 5-10 pages long with the smallest print you've ever seen. So here I just took 3 paragraphs from 10 pages to make it a little easier. But he has a lot that he argues in between. I just took the highlights that I thought were of interest to us. So here Rav Avadya writes the following. Nishalti, I was asked, b'misha achal basar, somebody who ate meat, v'achar shah o yoser, and after an hour or so, shachach uvirach amachalei chalav. They mistakenly go ahead and make a bracha. They see a delicious chocolate bar on the counter. They're not thinking. And they go ahead and make the bracha on it. Im mutter litom ktsas b'chadei shelo tehei brachasa levatela. Am I allowed to at least taste? Again, I don't have to finish the chocolate bar, but maybe I should be able to taste it in order that my bracha should not be considered a bracha levatela. And it goes into the 3 dots here, really highlight like 3 or 4 pages. So the 3 dots here, where basically he gets into a discussion of what is the nature of the isser of the violation of a bracha levatela. We know you're not supposed to say Hashem's name in vain. So does that mean also if I say a bracha that was not a necessary bracha, I'm in violation of that avera? That's the opinion of some Rishonim. Other Rishonim say, no. If you made a bracha and you thought you were supposed to make it, and then it turns out you made a mistake, that's not a violation of a bracha levatela. You weren't doing it in any disrespect to God. You weren't doing it with any disrespect in mind, and therefore we don't consider that a bracha levatela. That's a rabbinic prohibition. You have to think a little bit before you make a bracha. You shouldn't just be shooting brachas off without thinking. I remember I read once in one of Rabbi Fran's books, I forgot which one it was, but he has a discussion there about when he was an onen. So he lost his mother. Rabbi Fran writes very beautifully about how when he lost his mother, he was flying, I think, to Seattle, Washington. So it was a long flight from Baltimore to Washington. And he writes, he was an onen. The halacha is that a person who's in the state of aninus, right after they lose a relative, is not allowed to do mitzvahs, is not allowed to make any brachas. And he says he kept catching himself the whole flight, making a bracha on his water and on his snacks and on all the things they were serving. And then he said he realized afterward how we don't think about the brachas that we make. If we would only think for 1 second before we made a bracha, I would have reminded myself that while I'm an onen, I'm not allowed to be doing this. But because we don't think about it, and because we're just so used to making the brachas as we've been trained as children, so that's why, on the one hand, it's good, because that's our gut reaction. We never forget to make a bracha. On the other hand, we lose something, because we don't really think about what it is that we're doing. So the same is over here. Perhaps you'll say it's a biblical violation of a bracha levatela, of a losisa shem Hashem alokech alashav, if a person will go ahead and say a bracha that was not necessary, because you should think twice before you mention God's name. You should think more carefully before you just pick up the chocolate bar and make a bracha. Think about whether you're allowed to do this or not. And other Rishonim say no. So that's what he discusses. Is a bracha levatela worse, or is the practice of not eating milk within the 6 hours worse than that? So that's basically the discussion back and forth that he has. But then he quotes some other interesting applications of the very same halacha. Look at the next paragraph. Ra'isi. B'tshuvas minchasani, shenishal b'misha shachach lahavdil b'matzei Tisha B'Av shechal b'yom Aleph. So let's say you have Tisha B'Av falls out on a Sunday. So when do we make Havdalah? Right, Tisha B'Av is Matzah Shabbos Sunday. We don't make Havdalah Matzah Shabbos. We wait until Sunday evening. But one is not allowed to eat anything before making Havdalah. That applies, by the way, every Shabbos, not just on Tisha B'Av that falls out on Matzah Shabbos. That applies every Shabbos. A person is not allowed to eat or drink anything, even water, I think it says in Shulchan Aruch. You're not to eat or drink anything before the recitation of Havdalah. But over here, you just fasted a whole day, Tisha B'Av. You forgot all about it. You forgot that you didn't make Havdalah last night. And your husband is sitting in shul and he's schmoozing. And now you're at home and you want to eat. So you take a delicious piece of cake and you make a bracha. And then you say, we didn't make Havdalah. What are you going to do? So that's the same question. Do we allow you to take the bite of the cake in order that you should not violate the Yisra of a bracha levatela? Or do we say, no, Havdalah is more important. And therefore, even though it's going to mean that your bracha levatela is going to be considered a bracha levatela, too bad, it is what it is. So that's a second application. Turn to the next paragraph. Let's say somebody is on a fast day. and you're fasting and you're doing all kinds of things, but you have to cook dinner, and now you're cooking a soup or whatever you want to taste it. You forget all about the fact that you're fasting. I'm not sure how it's possible, but you go ahead and you make a bracha and you're about to eat it, and you say, hey, it's a public fast day today. I don't have a right to make this bracha. And finally, the last case that he quotes is somebody in the middle of the 9 days. You have somebody in the middle of the 9 days who's not allowed to eat meat, but now you have the Shabbos leftovers, you pull them out of the fridge, and you go ahead and you make a bracha on the chicken or the meat, whatever it was that you ate on Shabbos, and now you realize, before you eat it, you realize that I'm in the middle of the 9 days, I don't really have a right to go ahead and eat this thing that I made a bracha on because I'm supposed to be abstaining from meat. So all of these questions are very important ones, and you have to always judge in every particular case how to figure out which one is the better or worse of the two evils. How do you figure out what would take precedence? Would a bracha levatala be more important of a factor, or would the minig of not eating meat during the 9 days, or not eating on a public fast day, or not eating before Havdalah on Matzei Tisha B'Av, or our case, not eating during the 6 hours, what to do in a case like that is a very important shaila, but I think it's interesting that it comes up in many different scenarios. Amir Tisham next week, unfortunately.